It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish, co-editor of Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right, plenty to cover, so let's just dive right in. And let's start with local this week. There is actually some local news.
Imagine that.
It happens every once in a while. So the downtown Seattle had a big tractor pull earlier this week.
Yeah, they did. Supporters of I-933 came in and staged a little, essentially, media event and that, you know, got people to crane their necks because they're not used to seeing flatbed trucks and tractors going through downtown. And the whole idea, of course, was to frame I-933, which is the property rights initiative that basically says that if your property is affected by any kind of environmental regulation, you can sue to either get that regulation overturned or the government has to, state government has to reimburse you. Well, the process for getting a waiver for those regulations is almost impossible. So what it basically means is the state's going to have to pay out big money or rescind its laws. It's a tremendously dangerous initiative. It's being pushed by the Farm Bureau, which is why they had the tractors and flatbeds there. But, you know, primarily the people who are going to benefit from this are developers. They're not farmers. They're not ranchers. And in fact, if anything, it's a disadvantage of farmers because there'll be that much more pressure on them to sell to developers who will get every bit as much of a not only get everybody as much of a benefit from this initiative, but are less likely to care about stewardship of the land than farmers or ranchers are. So you had another interesting development on 933 this week, which is that all seven current and former governors, in Republican and Democrat alike, of the state of Washington came out against 933. And we've talked about in this program before why they might do something like that. There have been a couple of different studies that have estimated anywhere between $7 and $9 billion, B as in billion dollars, over the next 5 years that the state would have to pay out as a result of this initiative. There was one passed that was similar in Oregon last year, I believe it was, and they've had all sorts of problems and legal chaos and money that had to pay out as a result of it, and it would actually be that much more difficult to deal with here because of the difficulty of just, you know, granting individual waivers to the laws. So at last count, or last time I saw polling on this, it did look likely that it was going to pass. It had a fairly, you know, like something like a 48% to 30% lead. So, you know, the more public education we can do on this and the more people realize that it's either going to entirely eliminate land use and planning and growth management and zoning laws, or it's going to cost taxpayers, you know, many, many flatbeds worth of money. You know, the more we can get word on that out, the better a chance there is of actually turning this around and stopping it.
All right, moving along. County Council gives a thumbs up to oversight.
Yeah, this is something also that we've been following over the last couple of months since the Blue Ribbon panel actually endorsed the idea a couple of months ago. The King County Sheriff's Office needing civilian oversight after just a string of problems that go all the way back through Dave Reichert's reign as reign of error as sheriff and even back before that, actually, and on into the current administration of Sue Rahr. Remarkably enough, the full county council unanimously approved this week an office of law enforcement oversight. Now, the big hang-up there is that the Officers Guild, the King County Sheriff's Officers Guild, has said that they will go to court to try and prevent this from being implemented. And their current contract runs through next year, so they can delay it for up to a year until the next contract is negotiated. So it might not be implemented immediately. Chances are pretty good there's going to be some legal difficulties with the union, but you know, at some point this is actually going to take place, and once it does, it's actually a much stronger program than the Office of Professional Accountability that SPD has, which is badly in need of oversight, or rather reform. And you know, hopefully that's the next project that can be taken on by people who want to hold law enforcement accountable in our area.
All right. And developments in Sergeant Ricky Clausing's case.
Yes, he's another one of the folks who has been a GI resistor. He went AWOL rather than another deployment to Iraq. Was at the Veterans for Peace Convention nationally that was held here in Seattle in August, and then turned himself in at Fort Lewis. He's originally from Sumner, but he went AWOL from Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and that's where he was taken back to. And this week, he was sentenced to 3 months confinement for having gone AWOL. Actually, a relatively light sentence, but nonetheless, he was found guilty of his infringement and is going to do jail time as a result. So that's but there's been a steady stream of resistors at various military installations around the country just in the past few weeks. This is definitely a movement that is growing in momentum, and has especially done so since Lieutenant Aaron Watada went public with his resistance a few months ago.
All right, moving on to national. I'm not sure if this is going to become a regular spot, but you have some contenders for the new Sleaze of the Week award.
Yeah, well, we've had the last few weeks. I don't think we had it last week, but a few weeks, the 2 weeks prior to that, we had various Bush administration officials, the head of Housing and Urban Development a couple of weeks ago, and the week before that, I even forget what it was. Education Department, that's right, the Reading First program for No Child Left Behind. Well, we've got another Bush administration official this week that is in trouble. He is the former head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and I think they've actually tacked, oh, and explosives, they've actually tacked that on to the ATF acronym now, a guy named Carl Truscott. And rather than try to describe this to you, I'll just read the direct quote that Mr. Truscott authorized hundreds of thousands of dollars of questionable expenditures on a new ATF headquarters, personal security, and other items. And this is the part that I truly love, violated ethics rules by ordering 20 employees to help his nephew complete a high school video project. Now, I don't know about you, when I had high school projects or, you know, even a high school video project, I don't think I needed 20 of my uncle's employees to help me finish it. I mean, that's kind of amazing.
Sounds like quite the project.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I hope you got a good grade. I hope, you know, it was worth it since we paid for it. The other contenders this week, though, there's more. And, you know, you can't parody this stuff. You just can't. That was the executive branch. So we have a contender in the legislative branch also. This is the FBI announced this week that it's investigating a member of Senator Arlen Specter's staff. This is their moderate Republican from the state of Pennsylvania. They're saying that staff member broke the law by helping her husband, who is a lobbyist, secure almost $50 million in Pentagon spending for his clients. So that's Congress, where, you know, people talk about the culture of corruption. Well, there you go. And I'll get back to that with our next item also. And then finally, if you think, well, at least there's the free market and that'll fix all of the problems because, you know, that the invisible hand of, you know, whatever is got to be less corrupt than government, right? Well, not exactly. The House Energy and Commerce Committee reported this week that the oil company BP had lied to investigators during the investigation into the incident a couple months ago where they had to shut down the Prudhoe Bay pipeline system because of all the leaks in it. And we've talked in this program about how those leaks have been a recurring problem for years. Well, apparently, in the year 2001, Alaskan state regulators had ordered BP to inspect those pipelines, and BP just never did it, and once the problems got so bad they had to shut it down, they didn't bother to tell anybody about that 2001 investigation. So there you have it, American ethics in action for the week ending October 14th.
All right. Well, it appears that it's never too early for people to be jumping into the race for president, but this week we heard about somebody jumping out of the race.
Oh, yes. Well, we also had an Abramoff update.
Okay.
Anyway, which is that the Congressman Robert Nye, who was the first congressman to be indicted in the Abramoff operate, actually pled guilty this week to corruption charges, admitted that he basically was auctioning off his services as a congressman to various lobbyists associated with Jack Abramoff. He's now facing 27 months in prison. Sentencing will be in January. And there was a Senate report this week that Mercer Island's own Rabbi Daniel Lepin's Toward Tradition was one of five different nonprofits that Abramoff used to funnel money in tax-exempt ways from lobbyists to various favorite causes. Now, the quid pro quo there for Lappin and these other groups, Grover Nordquist was another really prominent one, in exchange for helping Abramoff. Giving him all this money to collect the interest on, what they did for Abramoff was they would write op-eds. They had their own staff people do it, and that were obviously unconnected to Abramoff, at least in the public eye. They would write op-eds that were favorable to Abramoff's clients. So it was this whole, it was this whole circle of corruption. So Abramoff isn't going away either. That just continues to play out, and several of the other congressmen who've been named in his probe, particularly Conrad Burns, the senator from Montana, and Richard Pombo and John Doolittle from California representatives are facing really serious re-election battles this year because of their ties to Abramoff.
All right. Well, now that you hosed my intro for Mark Warner, why don't you tell us who he is and why he's pulling out?
Well, Mark Warner is from Virginia, and he is a centrist, although he showed up at Daily Kos in Las Vegas a few months ago and really impressed a lot of the progressive bloggers there. He'd been setting himself up for a run for president, and he announced this week that he wasn't going to do it after all. The big beneficiary from that is Hillary Clinton, because it's one less sort of moderate DLC type trying to get the Democratic nomination. Joe Biden, I think, is the other major one, and then Bayh in Indiana also falls into that category. But what the person that probably hurts the most is somebody like Russ Feingold, because the more centrists that are in the race, the more they divide up the possible fundraising money, while he at this point has the progressive field pretty much to himself. Hillary is looking awfully good right now in terms of her ability to raise money for the Democratic presidential nomination, which is actually only a little over a year away, amazingly enough. We're talking about settling that sometime early in 2008.
All right, moving along. One can hear the most amazing things in bars these days, anytime.
Yeah, we had a report this week that an unnamed Marine Corps sergeant was chatting up some guards in Guantanamo, guards that actually worked in the Guantanamo base guarding detainees at, I think, Camp X-Ray is what they're calling it now. And she was saying and reporting to his superiors that these guards were talking about extensive incidences of in which they would abuse Muslim prisoners basically for the heck of it. Now, the interesting thing about this, we've heard these kind of allegations from a number of different sources before, from the Red Cross and human rights groups, from former detainees and their lawyers, investigative pieces in different international and domestic publications, etc. But what makes this interesting is that you would normally discount what we would call hearsay evidence, which is, pretty much the idea that you were talking to somebody in a bar and this is what they said. You can't use that in a court of law. Well, not after the torture and habeas corpus bill that was passed a few weeks ago. Now, when it comes to things like national security, hearsay evidence is just fine. So I think this is enough to hang the Guantanamo guards high and dry, don't you? I mean, just fair is fair, right?
Well, I'm not sure fair is fair applies anymore. And speaking of
fair
which,
is what we say it is.
Yeah. Speaking of which, there's a Human Rights Watch report out this week.
Yeah, in case you had ever wondered why so many of the perpetrators of abuse at places like Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and Bagram and so forth seem to come out of various prison systems in the U.S. in terms of being you know, becoming guards or interrogators in the National Guard or Reserve or whatever. Well, there's a direct correlation because a lot of those practices also came out of the U.S. prison system, as Amnesty and Human Rights Watch have been saying for years. And there was another report this week from Human Rights Watch saying that five states, Connecticut, Delaware, Idaho, right next door to us, South Dakota, and Utah, all are using unmuzzled dogs to terrify and even attack inmates during cell extractions in the state prison systems. Now, you know, this obviously is a fairly serious human rights problem, but that five separate states are doing it, you know, presumably without any kind of coordination, they all just think it's kind of a cool idea. Tells you a lot about the state of the U.S. And these are not control units; these are just ordinary state prisons. Tells you an awful lot about the state of the prison system in the U.S. And you know, there's reasons we hear so little about the abuses that we have in that system here at home.
All right, moving along to international. It appears that there is a new member of the nuclear club.
Yeah, week. And in fact, just in the last 24 hours, the United States government, whose, you know, credibility is impeccable, says that it has picked up radiation from, you know, over North Korea that it believes verifies the fact that North Korea did indeed launch a nuclear test this week, which would make it officially the eighth member of the nuclear club, unofficially the ninth, because, of course, Israel has had nuclear weapons for at least a couple, 3 decades. Mordechai Vanunu let us know that nearly 20 years ago. He is still in prison for that infraction of Israeli national security. You know, the United States never seems to have been disturbed by the fact that Israel, which has the longest-running illegal military occupation in the world, also has illegal nuclear weapons. But it gets really alarmed when people we don't like get them, or are even 5 to 10 years away from getting them, as Iran is. In this case, North Korea has exploded a nuclear device. And, you know, there's been sort of a lot of hand-wringing and among conservative critics, you know, blaming a treaty that was signed by Clinton in 1994 as, you know, having failed, and this is what... You know, this is what happens, and they're, you know, once again, they're blaming it on Clinton, who's been out of office for 6 years. Well, it doesn't exactly work out that way. The 94 treaty with North Korea actually put North Korea's plutonium and its nuclear facilities under seal with at least two IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, inspectors on site 24/7. That treaty held until 2002. What happened in 2002? Well, several things. Number one, George Bush walked away from the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. Another is that the rhetoric toward North Korea became extremely hostile. And there were some other developments as well. And, you know, basically North Korea at that point said, well, you know, screw it. If the United States is going to be hostile, and if, you know, the largest nuclear power in the world, and in fact the only power that's ever used nuclear weapons against a civilian population, is going to walk away from international commitments on nuclear nonproliferation, then there's, you know, absolutely no reason why we should honor it either. And particularly when the rhetoric is such that we feel that we need this as a deterrent against being attacked. And so they kicked out the IAEA inspectors and opened up the plutonium again, and that's almost certainly the plutonium that was used in the nuclear test this week. The other thing that has been coming out of the White House this week is that North Korea has been exporting its technology to Iran, which there is absolutely no evidence to support. Of course, who has gotten nuclear material spread around the world, including to North Korea in the first place, is our good ally Pakistan, which has by far been the worst nuclear proliferation in world proliferator rather in world history. They supplied North Korea, they supplied Libya. There are probably other underground networks involved at all. And recall that the Bush administration, when September 11th happened, not only enlisted Pakistan as an ally in the war on terror, but lifted the sanctions against Pakistan that were put in place when Pakistan joined the nuclear club in the late 1990s. So it's, shall we say, somewhat inconsistent and somewhat inept approaches to foreign policy by the Bush administration. And here we are with another member of the nuclear club.
Moving along, plenty happening this week in Iraq.
Yeah, tons going on this week. A study out of Johns Hopkins University published this week in Lancet, the same folks that published this an article in 2004 saying there were 100,000 additional Israeli civilian deaths in the first year after the invasion and occupation due to that invasion and occupation in Iraq. And I mentioned a few weeks ago that the epidemiologist who co-authored that study had estimated in April that it was now up two or more than 300,000, and that was before all the violence of the summer. Well, they were working on a study, and it turns out that rather than being this vast overestimate that number, people reacted to that number thinking it was a vast overestimate when I would mention it. It turns out he was low by a factor of two. The actual number that they came up with, and this is, you know, peer-reviewed, very sound epidemiological methodology that has not been questioned and, in fact, been extensively used by the U.S. government when the same methodology was used in Rwanda, in the Congo, and most recently in Darfur. But it's just when it's politically inconvenient that the U.S. government and our media sort of scoff at it, was 655,000. That is 1 in 40 Iraqis has died in the last 3.5 years due to the effects of the invasion and occupation by the U.S. Now, the most astounding thing about this was at his Wednesday press conference, somebody asked George Bush about this number. And he came back with a quote that, if it's possible to get even more insensitive and clueless than his quote about the violence in Iraq being a comma, he managed to top himself or lower himself or something this week. And I will just read the quote to you verbatim. Quote, and this is George Bush talking about the 655,000 casualty number in Iraq, or death number, rather, in Iraq. Quote, I am, you know, amazed that this is a society, talking about Iraq, which so wants to be free that they're willing to, you know, that there's a level of violence that they tolerate. In other words, he's saying that it's okay for Iraqis to have that much of a death toll because they want to be free. This is the most powerful man in the world speaking. It's really kind of frightening. There's just no comment you can make to that. Meanwhile, some interesting other folks speaking up this week. The U.S. Army's Chief of Staff, General Peter Shoemaker, said that the U.S. plans to have troops in Iraq at least until the year 2010. That's another 4 years. We've been there only 3 years so far. So, you know, heck, maybe that number will go up by another factor of three or four. However, shortly after that, the head of the British Army, the guy named Sir Richard Dannett, called for the UK to pull out of Iraq entirely, which is, you know, somewhat the opposite conclusion. And then also another Brit, a guy named David Blunkett, who was at the time, this is in 2002, 2003, the Home Secretary under Tony Blair, said that the UK under Blair, in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, tried very hard to warn Bush off Iraq, saying that it would be a disaster, but that they were, quote, powerless to do anything about it because Bush was so determined to invade Iraq. Now, you know, that can also be read as trying to salvage the reputation of Tony Blair, who's, you know, looking to be stepping down in the next year. But it's still a pretty damning indictment of Bush. And finally, we had, we got a couple more things. There was a report in the New York Times this week that 1 in 5 Afghanistan and Iraq vets filed claims as being at least partially disabled as a result of their wartime experience since the invasion of Afghanistan in late 2001. That's over 100,000 1,000 disability claims that have been granted so far, the vast majority of them from Iraq vets, and that projects out to at least 400,000, and I think this is before the 2010 estimate came out, so it might even be higher than that, but 400,000 that may eventually qualify for disability claims. Now, just in terms of raw numbers, let alone percentage, but in raw numbers, that's 40% more than all of the veterans of the Vietnam era, and the number of veterans that served in Vietnam was far greater, so it's probably more like a factor of two, and nobody's even begun to calculate the cost of that. I did some quick calculator and came up with, you know, if these are some of them are one-time payments, sometimes are some are monthly payments for the rest of their lives, rest of their lives being probably 50 years if these are, you know, early 20s kind of vets coming out of the armed forces, that could be a couple hundred billion dollars that we're talking about in disability claims. So a very expensive war for many, many years to come. And finally, we had a report in Britain's Sunday Times in London this week. Once again, you have to go overseas to find out things about the U.S. A congressional committee called the Iraq Study Group that's been convened by the Bush administration and congressional Republicans has been drawing up plans to partition Iraq. Now, mind you, in recent opinion polls, Iraqis are very much opposed to partitioning Iraq, but the U.S. is planning to do it for them anyway, apparently.
All right. And moving on, a article this week in Haaretz.
Yeah, and this was something also that appeared in the Israeli press, but not here in the U.S., which is that, according to Haaretz, the same Italian investigative team for television that uncovered the evidence of phosphorus use by the U.S. in Fallujah is now alleging that Israel used an experimental, untested weapon against Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip this summer, similar to the U.S. DIMA weapon that's basically micro-shrapnel using tungsten and other rare metals. It's very lethal. Also in the environment, it's extremely carcinogenic, stays around for a long time, is very environmentally destructive. Now, and again, that appeared in Haaretz, did not appear anywhere in U.S. media.
All right. And quickly, the Taliban and Islam.
Yeah, this also is in the Asia Times rather than any U.S. source, that the Taliban is planning a, quote, Islamic Intifada in 2007, and that's not just taking over Afghanistan. They're also planning to attack the northwestern provinces in Pakistan also and try and carve that land out too. So that could be a widening of that war as well.
And briefly, local events.
Got a couple coming up of interest this week. One of them is today from 12 to 5, where anti-war activists in North Seattle, basically all the neighborhoods north of the Ship Canal, are going to try and get together and form or reform or expand existing neighborhood groups to work against the war in Iraq. That's so come prepared to join a group and get some work done. It's from 12 to 5, Keystone Congregational Church, 5019 Keystone Place North, just off of 50th. And then Wednesday night, the annual Hanford State of the Site meeting is being held here in Seattle. That will be in Seattle Center at the Rainier Room. That's in the Northwest Rooms, I believe. There will be an open house and sort of overview of how the process works at 6 o'clock. And the meeting itself will be from 7 to 9.
All right. Talking with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. Volunteer publication, newspaper. We also are online. You get the newspaper free of charge wherever you get free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System, yada yada. Online, we're at www.eatthestate.org. If you have comments, tips, feedbacks, want to volunteer, donate, whatever you want to do. Heck, we just like phone calls sometimes. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.